Congress is pushing forward a new stimulus package. Will it pass, and will it be enough? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. This time, it's a $900 billion package that could mean up to $700 per person. But will the president sign off in his final act in office? We'll be speaking with Congresswoman Frederica Wilson about the aid and about her push for a national mask mandate. Also,
I just tried to think about who she was, make her interesting and complex and flawed. I think she's my favorite character I've ever made.
Roxane Gay is a culture critic, op-ed columnist, and award-winning author. Her debut novel, An Untamed State, explores Haitian-American identity and the problem of kidnapping in Port-au-Prince. WLRN's Wilkin Brutus spoke with Gay about the book, Fat Positivity, and the Me Too movement. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Leaders in Congress are trying to hammer out the details of a $900 billion stimulus package to help Americans during this pandemic. The package would include additional funding for small businesses and a $600 to $700 direct one-time payment to Americans. It could also mean help with rent and jobless aid. Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson represents parts of Miami and joins us now to help us understand more about this aid package and also a push for a national mask mandate. Congresswoman Wilson, thank you so much for the time. By the way, I just want to throw out the number. It's 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Let us know what you think. If you've got questions about the stimulus aid package or a national mask mandate, what do you think about that? Congresswoman, let me start off by talking about this aid package. Give us a little bit of details of what's going on right now.
Well, it's still moving. So right now, we know that the bill would extend by 16 weeks to April 19th, the following program, a $300 per week starting at the end of December. This is for unemployment compensation, and that would help a lot of our residents. We also know that they have put in emergency appropriations for health response and agency operations on the Title II for the Department of Health and Human Services. That's to help for the distribution and administration of the coronavirus vaccine. There's money in there for additional help for addiction and mental health. Also, emergency assistance for a strong economic recovery, Title III. That's transportation, hopefully, child care providers. And we have put a provision in that child care not only refers to small children, but it refers to all children, middle school children, high school children, wherever parents need child care. Also, agricultural assistance.
This package is a lot smaller than Democrats had originally hoped for. Are you happy with that? Are you okay with that?
I am okay with it for the moment. The two provisions that I wanted to be sure were included. I wanted a direct payment, a stimulus, a direct check to people who needed it. And I also wanted unemployment compensation. Everything else I felt could wait until the new president is elected or sworn in.
Yeah.
But what we have now is very comprehensive, and something new has been added. We have vaccines. So we have to make sure that that, too, is included in the program.
Yeah.
But when you're working with two bodies of Congress, you have to negotiate. So what I might want, someone else doesn't want.
Correct.
And what they want, I don't. But I just told you what my bottom line was.
Right. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. Again, talking about this federal stimulus package for Americans. If you have any questions about it, we're also going to talk about a national mask mandate. Again, 800-743-9576. Congresswoman, let me talk a little bit more about that direct payment to Americans. Back in the first stimulus, it was $1,200. Again, it's going to be a lot less. But you feel that, you know, $600-$700 per person, it's a one-time payment, is my understanding, that is sufficient right now? Are you okay with that?
I am okay because it's all we can get, and it's all that the Senate and the White House are willing to give. However, if it were left to me, I would have it means tested, and I would give every family who needed it $1,200 per month.
Who qualifies for this money? Who gets it?
Well, this is a one-time payment for everyone whose salary is under $100,000 a year.
Okay.
I don't necessarily agree with that because I know there are some people who never lost their job. They still work. Even my staff works, but they will get a stimulus. And I don't agree with that. But there's nothing we can do right now because it's too late.
Yeah.
But I always advocated for means testing, for stimulus checks to go out to people who actually needed them, and that would make the stimulus checks even more robust.
We spoke with your colleague in the Florida delegation, Ted Deutsch, and he expressed optimism that this proposal in the House has the potential to get to the president, and the president would sign off. Are you as optimistic?
I am, because we've watered it down to almost nothing, and it's something that we can use as a springboard until after the inauguration. So I'm fine with it, and I think that most of our colleagues are fine. We had some members of the Progressive Caucus, and I am a member of the Progressive Caucus, who didn't want to sign on to this bill unless we had a direct payment stimulus check. That has been worked out. So we do have one. It's small, but we have one. So I think that satisfied the last little group of holdouts in the House.
All right. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. I want to go to the phones. I've got Phil in Miami. Phil, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Go ahead.
Well, I just want to make a couple of comments that I'm a partner in a staffing firm in both Miami and Fort Lauderdale, and I would rather see the government pay people to go back to work versus pay people to stay at home. In the two offices that I have pre-COVID, you know, we run about 150 positions a week, you know, many like industrial, manufacturing, technical, and what's apparent to me pre-COVID, we had a no-call, no-show, or walk-off at lunch about 10%.
Yeah.
With government paying folks basically to stay at home or make more money to stay at home, that number now is probably over 50%.
Hmm.
We'll see people go all the way through the onboarding process, drug tests, everything, and still not show up to work.
All right. Congresswoman, go ahead. I'll let you please respond.
Well, no one has received an unemployment check since August, so no one is paying anyone to stay home. So that's not true. And I don't know who those people are that are being paid, because Florida ran out of its unemployment money August 1st, so no one has been paid a dime. So what we're trying to do is reinstitute it, and we have so many people on a waiting list who have applied for unemployment, but they never got it. So I'm sure they want to work.
All right.
You would be surprised how many people don't want to go to work.
I know, Phil. Thank you for the call. I know what Phil is bringing up, though, Congresswoman, is, you know, because and look, it's less money this time around. But one of the arguments in the first package was that with state unemployment and then the federal government check, some people were making more money that way than they were working. That's not a concern this time?
Well, let me say this. there are so many people who applied for unemployment, and the governor himself came out and said that he believed that the system was set up to just give a certain amount of people unemployment. So we still have people who never received unemployment compensation. And we have people who worked at the port, who worked for the airport, who worked for the seaport, who worked for all kinds of people. And unemployment did not exceed their salaries. So I'm not sure who you are talking about, because the people who basically made minimum wage, et cetera, those people worked throughout the pandemic. They are frontline workers who work in fast food restaurants, and they were never let go. So I don't know who and how this came about, because that's not true.
Again, talking with Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, the number is 800-743-9576. Again, they're working on that federal stimulus package now. I want to move over to this question of a mask mandate, and we don't have that. But, Congresswoman, you want to see a federal mask mandate. Why?
Well, I think across the country, COVID-19 cases are once again on the rise, and deaths are at their highest. We have over 1 million people in the state of Florida, 1 million people who have been affected by COVID-19. And I think in order to show the American people, we need to support bold policy to stem the spread of this virus. And we have all kinds of information that has shown us that wearing a mask will curb COVID-19.
Are you worried, though, that even President-elect Biden has said he doesn't want to see it on a federal level? He wants the states to figure this out.
Am I worried? No, I'm not worried. I understand what President-elect Biden is saying. He only has the authority to do it on federal properties, and that's what he plans to do. But as a member of Congress, I think it's my responsibility to stand up for what I know is wrong. And I think that in order for our constituents to live, and in order for us to stamp out this virus, we have to follow the science.
And how
and the
do you?
Science says.
The science says
mask,
wear masks.
You wear a mask, you wash your hands, and you socially distance.
Right.
And let me just give you an example.
Well I want to. Go ahead. Go ahead.
People in Japan have been wearing masks prior to the virus. They wear a mask every day. If you go to Japan, everyone is wearing a mask. And the last time we checked, they had less than 1,000 people with coronavirus and one death.
Okay, so that's an interesting point. That's an interesting point. But there, they have different, you know, rules on enforcement. How do you enforce that in this country, a federal mask mandate?
Well, how will we enforce it here in Miami-Dade County when we had a mask mandate for Miami-Dade County, at which caused our numbers to plummet? And then when the governor lifted it, then all of a sudden it's on the rise. So I think what is so disingenuous about this whole coronavirus, this novel coronavirus, is that people in their hearts and minds feel that this is the flu, that this is something that's so simple and so easy. But if they did the kind of grunt work that I do, they would know the suffering, the side effects, the after effects, and the pain in the families who lose people to the COVID-19.
You
so
said
this
it
is
though.
A very serious issue. Very serious.
It is, and you said something interesting. You mentioned the governor. How do you work with the governor to convince Governor DeSantis of a federal mask mandate and to enforce that within his state when he doesn't want to?
Well, we said that there will be penalties for governors who say that, and we hope that we can get around that. And he will be able to listen because he wants to do the best for his state. And also, I do what I can do, and I think that all of our local politicians try to do the same by example, by wearing masks, by encouraging people to wash their hands, and by showing that this is something that we need to take seriously, by social distancing. I built two cemeteries in my district and have people are there every day writing the names of their loved ones on the headstones.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a family. Well, let me say this. I don't think there's a person in Dade County and Broward County, which I represent, who doesn't know someone who has been affected by COVID-19.
That's
horrible.
Let me ask you this, though, about the enforcement aspect of it. Because you've seen it. We've all seen these videos on social media. They're officers who react very differently to black and brown people not wearing their mask compared to their white counterparts. How do we get around that? How do we deal with this issue of not criminalizing the issue of mask wearing? And again, some people will probably be impacted differently. They'll be treated differently.
Well, what I suggested to our local police officers was to carry masks with them. And not only ask people to wear a mask, but give them a mask to wear. And I think that'll cut down some of the problems and some of the issues if you have a mask to wear. And then in my bill, it actually, you remember when we went through the HIV/AIDS days when people had vending machines for condoms everywhere? We
Yes.
could have vending machines in every mall, every restaurant with masks, where people can just get a free mask, a cheap free mask
right.
to wear in a restaurant, to wear on the street, just a disposable mask that they can use and just throw away. That has to become almost like wearing seatbelts. It took a long time. I was in the legislature when we finally got to the end of mandating seatbelts.
Well, hopefully,
city by city, county by county, we got it. And I'm not just talking about wearing masks and stop because we have a vaccine. We've got to wear this mask until we conquer this virus.
Right. And hopefully we conquer the virus before we get to the point where we have to pass those kind of laws. Again, Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson. Learn more about her national mask mandate bill. Also, we'll keep you updated on the stimulus package that Congress is now negotiating. Again, it's a $900 billion package. We'll keep you updated on that as well. Congresswoman, thank you so much. Have a wonderful holiday. Stay safe and have a great new year.
Thank you, and stay. Bye-bye.
Definitely. All right, again, that's Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson. Well, still to come, author Roxane Gay on her debut novel, An Untamed State. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Roxane Gay is an award-winning author, cultural critic, and a New York Times op-ed columnist. Her 2014 collection of memoirs, Bad Feminist, launched her on the national stage, landing on the New York Times bestseller list and achieving critical acclaim. She's become a thought leader on fat positivity, LGBTQ rights, racial inequality, and the Me Too movement. Gay's debut novel, An Untamed State, takes readers to Port-au-Prince. Marielle Duval is a Haitian-American woman from Miami visiting family when she's suddenly kidnapped. The novel details her horrific experience in captivity, her eventual release, and her ongoing recovery from trauma. WLRN's Wilkin Brutus spoke with Roxane about An Untamed State yesterday.
Roxane, it's obviously great to have you here. An Untamed State was published 6 years ago. The problem of kidnappings in parts of Haiti unfortunately remains as relevant today as it did then. Why did you want to write this novel at that time, and what was the inspiration behind it?
You know, I had been interested in this phenomenon of kidnappings in Haiti, and I was interested because you have to think, how desperate are people that they would turn to this kind of violence? And so that was really interesting to me. And I had read a few articles about it, and then I just thought, okay, I'm going to write something about this. And so I wrote a short story called Things I Know About Fairy Tales. And Mireille would not leave me. I just felt like the character had more to tell. And so I expanded it into a novel. And I just wanted to look at the issue. But really, I was just trying to tell a good story. And in some ways, it's a crime thriller. And in other ways, it's a family exploration. And you know, a lot of people would think that the worst thing for a woman to go through would be sexual violence. But I thought, no, the worst thing would be to know that the people who were best positioned to save you didn't. And so I decided that the father was going to be reluctant to pay the ransom and would hold out for 13 days. And so in the end, Mireille is trying to contend with not only what she went through, but the fact that her father could have ended her suffering and chose not to, for reasons he thought were justifiable.
You said you read a couple articles and felt inspired through that. I had a few people on Instagram who wanted to know if you had any personal experiences with any of this as well.
Yeah. After I wrote the novel, my aunt was kidnapped. And, you know, it's definitely one of those things, like, to this, it's been, I wrote the novel about 8 years ago. And it's been about 7 years since her kidnapping. And she was held for 2 days. And relatively speaking, she was very lucky. But it still affects her. And, it still affects her.
Having read a number of your essays, I hear your voice shine through the main character, but she is like fundamentally a different person from you. Explain your writing process and creating her personality and narrative.
Oh, you know, you just build a character step by step. So I, I was just trying to think of who would this young woman be and what would she be dealing with? And for whatever reason, people to this day think that I was the one who was kidnapped. And when I'm on book tour, they will come up to me and say, oh, how are you doing after your kidnapping? And I'm just like, wait, what kidnapping are you talking about? I was never kidnapped. And so I'm glad that people feel like it was so authentic that they assumed it was my story. But I just tried to think about who she was and flesh out who she was and make her interesting and complex and flawed and ultimately, you know, just this wonderful and very interesting woman. I think she's my favorite character I've ever made.
Wow. That's saying a lot. That's huge. you and I are Haitian American.
Yes, we are.
So let's talk about Haiti's perception here. Every Haitian American writer, an artist faces the burden of representing Haiti in its best light, but a story is essentially a memory in a specific space and time, right? A lot of Haitians understand the troubles of Haiti, but also yearn for its redeeming qualities to take center stage. Did you grapple with some of that pressure to show the great sides of Haiti to outsiders? And if so, how did you overcome it, especially since a lot of foreign policies had a negative impact on the socioeconomic condition of Haiti?
I really debated whether or not I should put this novel into the world because of the overwhelmingly negative perception that people have of Haiti. And I did not want to contribute to that negative perception in any way. And, you know, it is unfortunate that creators of color, and especially Black creators, must contend with the burden of representation. The rules are different for us. And I'll admit that I was very frustrated by that as I thought about how the book would be perceived. And so at the end of the day, I just thought, nobody tells Dennis Lehane not to write his crime novels about Boston and say, oh, how do you think this is going to reflect on Boston? And we deserve that freedom creatively. We do. Now, you know, what we deserve and what we have are two very different things. And so I understand that I have a responsibility, and I know that I disappointed some people. I know that people were very frustrated with my portrayal, but I wasn't portraying Haiti. I was portraying one criminal, you know, and he is not indicative of the entire country. It's a complex place. Terrible things happen there. And it's also the most beautiful place in the world, with the best music, the best food by far, the best art. And so all of these things can be true at once. And I think it's really important that we create space for multiple truths to coexist.
I'm speaking with the best-selling author, columnist, and culture critic, Roxane Gay. We are discussing her book, An Untamed State, about a Haitian-American woman from Miami who was kidnapped in Port-au-Prince. You can learn more about the book and the Sundial Book Club by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. During the initial kidnapping in the book, you wrote, quote, "The man sneered at me, called me Jaspoa." To those people who don't know what Jaspoa would mean, it's diaspora. "With the resentment of those Haitians who cannot leave hold for those of us who can," end quote. Today, there are many Haitian American entrepreneurs trying to make a socioeconomic impact in Haiti. But do you think there is still a fractured relationship?
Yeah, absolutely. There will always be a fractured relationship. And I get why. And, you know, what's interesting and what's challenging is that so many members of the diaspora want to go back and want to contribute. Like, my father went back 21 years ago and is still there and still working there, because he cares very much. I mean, no one will ever take the Haitian out of him. And so, you know, I do hope that that relationship can be mended. And I think it's gotten much better than it used to be. But when you look at the economic conditions and the political climate, I understand why some people would be resentful of the diaspora and the ways in which people can sort of fly in and out at will. When it's so hard to get a visa for Haitian citizens to come here, it can be, especially for people without money, it can be nearly impossible. And that's a grave injustice. And, you know, how do we deal with that and acknowledge that injustice and try to rectify it while still wanting to return to what is our homeland?
Yeah, it's tough navigating that dichotomy for sure. Without giving too much of the novel away, Milwe experiences horrific violence and sexual assault at the hands of her captors. You've been quite outspoken about your own experiences with sexual trauma. Is writing about rape from a fictional perspective or in your personal essays and memoir a part of your own personal healing process?
Not intentionally, certainly. Therapy is part of my healing process. But can writing be cathartic? Absolutely. When I'm writing about it in fiction, not so much, but certainly when I wrote my memoir, Hunger, I didn't intend for it to be, but it ended up being one of the most cathartic writing experiences of my life thus far. And it was really helpful to me in starting to make some changes in my life.
I think many readers, including myself, was quite struck by how much of the book explores the aftermath of Mue's kidnapping when she returns home. Because, you know, how her trauma shapes her relationship with her husband and her family. In so many kidnapping stories, it simply ends with the person being rescued and then, you know, reunited. Why was the aftermath so critical for you to explore?
Well, for exactly that reason. Generally, when you see trauma in film and television, the person is released and then like 6 months later, everything is fine. And that's actually not the way that trauma recovery works for most people. It's an ongoing and for many people, never ending process. And it has its ups and downs and everything can be altered. And so I wanted to show like, what would the actual aftermath of an experience like this be like? You know, because people would expect that she would have this immediate and loving reunion with her husband, but you know, what if she's so traumatized that she can't open herself up to him or to her child or to her parents? Of course, what would that look like? And where would she go? Who would she turn to? And so those are definitely things I wanted to explore in the novel.
Yeah, definitely a story about a woman's resilience, finding her way, essentially. You also seem to explore the strong Black woman trope. You wrote, quote, "My father's parents both died when he was young, in ways that disgusted him, in ways he once told us that showed him that the only way to survive this world is by being strong," end quote. And that opens a window into his, like, stubborn personality. But it also tackles a strong Black woman trope. Was that something you wanted to explore as well?
Yeah, it was, because, you know, a lot of times people place these unreasonable expectations on Black women that we can endure all and that we don't experience pain and that we are willing to be incredibly... that we're willing to take care of everyone but ourselves. And that's just not reality. And so Mireille in the story is raised by a father, well, by parents, especially her father, though, who's domineering and who expects perfection from his children and expects impervious strength. And so when something shattering happens to her and her father's unreasonable expectations simply can't be met, you know, I definitely wanted to see what that might look like for her.
You're listening to a conversation between author Roxane Gay and WLRN reporter Wilkin Brutus. You can learn more about An Untamed State and hear the full interview by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, we continue our conversation with Roxane and discuss fat positivity, the Me Too movement, and comic books. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, let's go back to our conversation with author, cultural critic, and New York Times contributing op-ed columnist Roxane Gay. We were speaking with her about her debut novel, An Untamed State, which tells the story of a Haitian-American woman from Miami who's kidnapped in Port-au-Prince. The book came out in 2014, which was the same year her best-selling collection of essays, Bad Feminist, was released. WLRN's Wilkin Brutus spoke with Gay last night. We'll post the full interview on our website later today.
2014 was quite the year for you. And I remember reading Bad Feminist because as a heterosexual male, I want to learn about different perspectives, right? And you talked about the performative aspects of feminism, what it means to be a feminist, how one can reinforce essentialist identity politics or whatnot, right? It was released several years before the Me Too movement, and so many of the stories took a critical eye at gender dynamics in the workplace. As you were writing these essays in Bad Feminist and putting the book together, did you have any sense that a national cultural reckoning was upon us?
No, I didn't. I certainly hoped that sort of reckoning would be on the horizon, but you know, 2014 was in many ways a lifetime ago. So much has changed in the interim. And I did not know that there would finally be this cultural explosion with regards to sexual violence where people would finally face it and have serious conversations about just how pervasive it is. What it really shows is that some things never change. And we really see that with the fact that the essays that I wrote in, frankly, I started writing those essays in 2010, and that a decade later, it could have been written today. It just shows that very little changes for women and that our work continues.
Yeah, you said the work continues. What do you think the Me Too movement accomplished? And as a bisexual Black woman, do you believe this summer's protest for racial justice made any progress for queer Black women?
I don't know. how much progress was made. I think we're still in the middle of it. You know, what it certainly did is increase awareness around these issues. And Time's Up, as an organization that was that rose out of it, and Tarana Burke's organizing as well, have shown that you can sustain efforts in this space. But until we start to see sustained policy change and unilateral consequences for people who commit acts of sexual predation or violence, you know, we have a long way to go. We can sort of still point, okay, to Harvey Weinstein, to Bill Cosby, but as long as we can continue to just still name the perpetrators who have faced consequences while countless others remain free of consequence, you know, we have a big problem.
And what do you mean by policy change? What needs to happen, in your opinion?
You know, we need to see organizations have clear-cut rules about sexual harassment in the workplace, and then we have to see these organizations follow through on those consequences. I mean, there are plenty of organizations that have rules against sexual harassment, but they don't do anything about it when it occurs, and so we have to address that.
And what has, like, the pandemic been like for you? What has it exposed about how this society treats bodies, Black bodies, and where do we go from here?
You know, the pandemic has been interesting. Publicly, it's been a, you know, for many people, it's been a nightmare. And, you know, I don't think that we're going to know for a while just how traumatized many people are by what has taken place and the federal indifference. You know, personally, though, it's been pretty good, which, you know, it's hard to say because for so many people, they're losing their jobs and they are losing their homes and no one is doing anything about it. And, you know, certainly I lost most of my income and frankly, I don't know when it's going to come back. And that's terrifying, but I married well. So no, I'm just kidding. I had savings, but I also married well. And so I used to tour and I was on the road every week and all over the world. And I loved that. And I can't wait to get back to it, but it's exhausting to get on a plane every week and to have to go speak in front of thousands of people and be interesting and engaging and then do it all again the next night. And so I have really appreciated staying home. After 3 weeks, that was the longest I had been in one place for 6 years. Wow. And so that was good. My wife and I, she's based in New York and I'm based in Los Angeles. And so we had never lived together.
Interesting.
And so now we live together. We go back and forth together.
I'm speaking with the best-selling author, columnist, and culture critic, Roxane Gay. So recently, I was navigating the depths of Twitter hell, and one huge conversation on Twitter was about Lizzo, and I thought about your book, Hunger, and thought, when I speak to you, perhaps I could juxtapose what was going on with that conversation. So for those who don't know, the pop singer Lizzo, who is known for celebrating big girls all around the world, you know, she sparked a heated body positivity debate after posting a smoothie detox video. Some encouraged her, others saw hypocrisy. What's the importance of body positivity movement and perhaps some of its pitfalls?
Body positivity and fat positivity are a necessary corrective to a very fat phobic world that we live in that tells fat people that we are less than and that we don't deserve to be treated with dignity or consideration. But, you know, every movement has its extremes. And when you are a public figure and you are fat, people demand that you lose weight until you lose weight. And then they say you're betraying the movement for losing weight. And so you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And it's truly untenable and unfair. And so what Lizzo has been dealing with for the past couple days is people who felt like finally they had this public and amazing and sexy and talented icon who was now going back on her word, we saw it with Adele too. People, and I love Adele. People wrote Adele's ass about her weight over and over and over again. And so she lost the weight and now they're obsessed and they're fawning. And some people are like, oh my God, she lost too much weight. Or she looks amazing, but she always looked amazing. Like she was hot from day one. And she will always be hot no matter what her body looks like. And not despite her body, but because I thought she was lovely at her previous size and she's lovely now. But you know, people have really given her a hard time and they're now going to do that with Lizzo as whatever journey she chooses to be on. And the thing is, people really overreacted yesterday because Lizzo just did a detox. And I'm sorry, but this is Los Angeles. Even I do detoxes. It's part of the culture. And so it's really not shocking or out of the realm of logic that she did a detox. And so the way that people reacted lets you know, like, just the ridiculous pressures that fat women, public women, black women deal with.
Yeah, it brought me back to hunger. It also brought me back to Bad Feminist. And so did you see any elements of that outrage where it was largely women in that to that extent, where the backlash and support came? There was like this montage between the two responses. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think women police other women a great deal, but we do it because of the patriarchy. And so, like, let's put the blame where it ultimately belongs, which is with men. But, you know, we do see a lot of sort of the tensions of feminism when we see women both cheering and criticizing her and using feminism as the justification for either extreme. And I think when we see that, it's really important that we interrogate our motives and, like, what we're really saying. Because I think that the most ideal feminism says bodies shouldn't even be part of the conversation unless we want them to be. Just like let people exist in whatever kind of body they want to exist in, and let's celebrate a range of bodies. Just think what we could do for an entire generation of fat kids if we did not shame them constantly and inundate them with messaging. Like, I think that they would gravitate toward different choices if they were embraced instead of reviled. And I think that applies to everyone who's in an unruly body.
Yeah, speaking of messages about the unruly body, I was struck listening to an interview you had with Nicole Byers on her podcast, Why Won't You Date Me?
Yeah,
and
that was great.
Yeah, that was good. And you talked about how excited you were to speak with Terry Gross and how disappointed you were with her approach to the interview.
So you write that at your heaviest, you were 577 pounds, or 6'3". Since we're going to be talking in part about your body and your body size, I would appreciate it if you would guide me about what language you'd like me to use in terms of describing the size of your body. Honestly, like, I don't... Words are so loaded when it comes to body image, and everybody has their own preference for what word they use, so I'd like you to guide me on that?
I think fat works well.
Good. I'm good with that. Okay.
In public radio world, we put gross, a lot of people put gross on a pedestal, but you know, we are all fallible. What do media organizations get wrong about how we talk about bodies, specifically black bodies, and how we report on them?
You know, the media just does not know how to talk about fat. Because they're always sort of stumbling over themselves, and you can tell that they're trying to be what I hate this term, but they're trying to be politically correct and just, like, you know, call it what it is. Like, just use the word fat, it's okay. And so many people are afraid of the word fat because it has historically been used as an insult and continues to be used as an insult. But what if you just use it as an adjective? Like, this is a fact. Fat is fat, and it's okay. Like, there's no shame in it. And so I wish the media would embrace that.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you about, you know, the Black Panther, because I did have some of your fans on my Instagram ask her about, you know, her and Ta-Nehisi Coates and what happened with Black Panther and why was it canceled? And I'm like, why are you angry at me? Like, chill. I didn't cancel it.
Yeah, yep.
Oh, but now you have Showtime. You potentially have some work coming out. Talk to me.
Yeah, I always have work coming out. So Black Panther was awesome. I loved writing it. And it was a great opportunity. I was given a lot of creative independence and freedom. And I was really happy with how it sold. But Marvel wanted better sales. It just comes down to economics. I feel like Marvel definitely understands that they need to diversify their creators, but they don't know how to reach our audiences. And they don't know how to educate our audiences. Because when I first got the job at Marvel, I didn't know anything about how to buy comics. It's a whole thing. It's a specialized...
Oh yeah, the distribution process is completely different.
It's a thing. Like, there's a lingo, and there's a way that the stores are, and like you have to find the store, and it's a thing. It's not like you just walk into Barnes & Noble. Yeah. And so a lot of my fan base, which will follow me almost anywhere, you know, just didn't even know. And it wasn't until it came out as a trade paperback that they could get at Barnes & Noble, or at their, more ideally, at their favorite independent bookstore, Books & Books in Miami, shout out. That's when I felt like things really picked up. And so they really do need to think about how they reach people beyond the prototypical comic book reader, like that sort of standard white guy. And until they do that, you know, I don't think they're going to see a lot of sales. But they also need to find ways to let that particular audience know that reading about diverse kinds of characters and heroes isn't taking your medicine, and it's not like you're doing your social justice homework. You're just reading awesome stories from people who don't look like you, which is what literally every person of color does always. And so hopefully, you know, with they're continuing to hire amazing writers of color, and hopefully, you know, some of those writers will be given more than one shot.
That is author Roxane Gay speaking with WLRN's Wilkin Brutus. And if you want to read more about her novel, An Untamed State, or find her essays and more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that is Sundial for this Thursday, December 17th. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepery. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. And, of course, our intern is Saria Reimer. And, of course, don't forget that our program can always be caught at night. You can find us at 8 o'clock or find our podcast, because you can always listen on your own time. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. All right. That is our program. 2020 is come to an end for us. It's been a really tough year. It has. Sundial's going to take a couple of weeks off for the holidays. For the next 2 weeks, you'll be hearing Here and Now and special NPR holiday programming in place of the show. We're going to be back with live shows beginning January 4th. You can listen back to all of our old Sundial interviews, including the book club conversations. Just go to WLRN.org. You can also check out our series, Live from the 305, profiling the musicians that shape South Florida's culture and art scene. All the shows that you've been listening to, all the show you've been listening to, Black Violin, who premiered season 3 of our series. And find that interview and listen to the holiday album, Give Thanks, again on our social media, WLRN Sundial. And I just want to say, you know, for all the crew, for everybody here at WLRN, it has been a tough year. But you know what? We've gotten through it. I want to thank you, the listener, though, because you have been there for us and helped us to grow. We found ourselves in a situation with this pandemic and, you know, not wanting to be overwhelming, not wanting to, you know, make it too much for you to handle. But at the same time, we wanted to make sure that we covered the issues, that we covered the news properly, that we didn't scare you, but we informed you and kept you informed throughout. And it wasn't just the pandemic, we had an election as well. 2020's over. It's finally over. It doesn't mean we're out of the woods yet, still a pandemic to deal with, but let's come back in 2021, take a deep breath, set some goals, and do the best we can to be good to each other and to stay safe And we're going to get through it. And by the time 2021 is over, it is going to be the greatest comeback year of all for all of us. Let's make it that. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, thank you so much for listening. As I always say, stay safe, be good to each other. We'll talk to you again in 2021. So hang the shining star for the highest bow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas now.